A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking what POTS actually is, why electrolyte water and sodium help so much for people who have it, and how autonomic dysregulation is implicated in conditions like long COVID. And honestly, this is one of those topics where the surface-level explanations completely miss what's clinically interesting.
They really do. And by the way, today's episode is being written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, which feels appropriate for a topic that requires parsing a lot of physiological signaling pathways.
I'm sure DeepSeek is thrilled to be parsing sodium channels with us. But yes, let's get into it. POTS, Postural Orthostatic Tachycardia Syndrome. The name alone is a mouthful, and most people just hear you get dizzy when you stand up and move on.
Which is like saying a car engine just makes noise. Technically true, completely inadequate. POTS is a form of dysautonomia, a malfunction of the autonomic nervous system. The autonomic nervous system is the part that handles everything you don't consciously control. Heart rate, blood pressure, digestion, temperature regulation, pupil dilation, sweating. It's running in the background constantly. In POTS, the specific failure is that when a person stands up, their body can't maintain proper blood flow back to the heart and brain.
What's actually happening in those first few seconds when someone with POTS stands up?
Normally, when you stand, gravity pulls about 500 to 800 milliliters of blood down into your legs and abdomen. Your autonomic nervous system detects the drop in pressure and immediately responds. Blood vessels in the lower body constrict, heart rate increases slightly, and your body keeps cerebral perfusion stable, all within seconds. In POTS, that vasoconstriction doesn't happen properly. Blood pools in the lower extremities, the heart isn't getting enough return volume, so it compensates by beating faster, often much faster. The diagnostic criterion is an increase of 30 beats per minute or more within 10 minutes of standing, or above 120 beats per minute without a significant drop in blood pressure.
That's a massive jump, going from 70 to 100 beats per minute just from standing up.
That's a mild case. I've seen patients go from 70 to 130. Their hearts are essentially sprinting while they're just standing still. The heart thinks it's running a marathon because it's not getting enough volume. And that's where the symptoms cascade. Lightheadedness, brain fog, palpitations, sometimes syncope, exercise intolerance, chronic fatigue. The brain is being underperfused.
The heart isn't the problem. The heart is reacting rationally to bad information.
That's the key misconception. Most people hear tachycardia and think cardiac problem. In POTS, the heart is usually structurally normal. It's doing exactly what it's supposed to do when it senses low volume. It speeds up. The problem is upstream, in the autonomic nervous system's control of vascular tone.
Which brings us to Daniel's second question. Why sodium and electrolyte water? This is one of those things that sounds like wellness influencer nonsense until you understand the mechanism.
It's actually straightforward physiology. Sodium is the primary extracellular cation. It determines your blood volume. When you consume sodium, your body retains water to maintain osmotic balance. More sodium means more water retained in the bloodstream, which means more blood volume. For a POTS patient, that increased volume directly addresses the core problem. It gives the heart more to pump, so it doesn't have to work as hard.
It's essentially a volume expander, not that different from what they'd do with IV saline in an emergency department.
The standard POTS protocol often recommends 8 to 10 grams of sodium per day, sometimes more, combined with 2 to 3 liters of water. For context, the general population is told to stay under 2 POTS patients are consuming 4 to 5 times that amount, and it's therapeutic. The sodium pulls water into the vascular space, plasma volume increases, and that 30-beat jump on standing might become 15 or 20. Not a cure, but significant symptom reduction.
If the autonomic nervous system is the problem, why does just adding volume help? Shouldn't the body just pee out the excess and return to baseline?
It does, partially, which is why POTS patients have to maintain this constantly. but the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system in many POTS patients is actually dysregulated in a way that works in their favor for once. There's a subset of POTS patients who have low aldosterone, low renin, and paradoxically low blood volume to begin with, sometimes 10 to 15% below normal. Their kidneys aren't holding on to sodium efficiently. So when you supplement aggressively, you're compensating for a regulatory failure.
That's fascinating. The same system that's supposed to regulate blood pressure is underperforming, and the treatment is to brute force your way past it with intake.
It's not just sodium. Electrolyte waters typically include potassium, magnesium, sometimes calcium. Potassium is critical for nerve signal transmission and muscle contraction, including the smooth muscle in blood vessel walls. Magnesium is a cofactor in hundreds of enzymatic reactions, including those involved in vascular tone. The autonomic nervous system relies on proper electrolyte gradients to fire signals correctly. If you're depleted in multiple electrolytes, the signaling gets even worse.
The electrolyte water serves two functions. The sodium expands volume, and the supporting electrolytes help the nervous system actually send its signals properly.
That's a good way to frame it. There's also the glucose transport mechanism to consider. Many electrolyte drinks include a small amount of glucose because sodium absorption in the small intestine is coupled to glucose via the SGLT1 transporter. Glucose and sodium are co-transported across the intestinal wall. That's why oral rehydration solutions, the ones used for cholera, for severe dehydration, always include glucose. It's not for energy, it's a molecular pump for sodium uptake.
The World Health Organization formula, right?
The WHO oral rehydration salts formula is based on that exact principle, developed in the 1960s and 70s. It saved millions of lives, and the same transport mechanism is why POTS patients benefit from properly formulated electrolyte drinks, rather than just eating salt tablets with water.
The difference between a good electrolyte drink and just chugging salt water is genuinely physiological, not marketing.
Salt tablets without glucose and other electrolytes can actually cause GI distress and don't absorb as efficiently. There's real formulation science here.
Let me push on something. Sodium loading raises blood pressure. That's the whole reason the general population is told to reduce sodium. Are POTS patients trading one problem for another?
It's a fair concern, and it's why this should be done under medical supervision. But POTS patients, by definition, don't have a blood pressure problem in the same direction. Their blood pressure typically doesn't drop significantly on standing. That's actually what distinguishes POTS from orthostatic hypotension. And many POTS patients have low resting blood pressure to begin with. The sodium loading brings them to normal, not to hypertensive. If someone has hyperadrenergic POTS, which is a subtype, they can actually have high blood pressure on standing, and sodium loading needs to be more carefully managed.
Let's go there, because I think this is where the long COVID connection gets interesting.
There are several recognized POTS subtypes, and patients often have features of more than one. The main ones, neuropathic POTS, where there's damage to the small nerve fibers that control vasoconstriction in the legs. The nerves literally can't signal the blood vessels to tighten. Hyperadrenergic POTS, where the sympathetic nervous system is overactive, standing triggers a massive norepinephrine surge, sometimes over 600 picograms per milliliter. These patients get tremors, anxiety-like symptoms, palpitations, and their blood pressure actually rises. Then there's hypovolemic POTS, where blood volume is chronically low, often due to the renin-aldosterone dysregulation I mentioned.
Neuropathic POTS connects to small fiber neuropathy.
This is the mechanism that's become central to understanding long COVID POTS. Small fiber neuropathy is damage to the small unmyelinated nerve fibers, the C fibers and A delta fibers. These fibers innervate blood vessels, sweat glands, and internal organs. They're responsible for autonomic functions. When they're damaged, the signals that tell blood vessels to constrict in the legs when you stand, those signals don't arrive, or arrive weakly. Blood pools, heart rate spikes, you get POTS.
How does a viral infection damage these nerve fibers?
Multiple proposed mechanisms, and they're not mutually exclusive. One is direct viral neurotoxicity. The virus infects the nerve cells or the supporting cells. SARS-CoV-2 uses the ACE2 receptor to enter cells, and ACE2 is expressed on neurons and vascular endothelial cells. Another mechanism is immune-mediated damage. The body produces autoantibodies that target autonomic nerve fibers or the receptors. There's growing evidence for autoantibodies against adrenergic receptors, muscarinic receptors, and ganglionic acetylcholine receptors in long COVID patients with POTS.
Autoantibodies. So the immune system clears the virus and then turns on the nervous system.
That's the working hypothesis for a significant subset. A study from 2021 in the Journal of the American Heart Association found that about 25 to 50% of long COVID patients met diagnostic criteria for POTS. More recent research has found functional autoantibodies targeting G protein-coupled receptors in a significant portion of these patients. The immune system produces antibodies that either block or overstimulate autonomic receptors, and the result is dysregulation.
This isn't unique to COVID, right? POTS has been documented after other viral illnesses.
Post-viral POTS was recognized long before COVID, Epstein-Barr virus, influenza, Lyme disease, even some bacterial infections. The difference is scale. When a virus infects hundreds of millions of people globally, even a small percentage developing post-viral dysautonomia creates a massive new patient population. Estimates suggest that between 2 and 14% of COVID survivors develop some form of post-acute sequelae, and POTS is one of the most common cardiovascular manifestations.
2 to 14% is an enormous range. What's the better data saying now?
The large cohort studies are converging on something like 5 to 10% of COVID survivors having persistent autonomic symptoms at 6 months. A 2023 Nature Medicine paper tracking over 150,000 veterans found significantly elevated risk of dysautonomia diagnoses in the post-COVID group compared to controls. The absolute risk increase for POTS specifically was about 4 per 1,000, which sounds small until you multiply it by the number of infections globally.
We're talking about potentially millions of new POTS cases worldwide.
A healthcare system that was not prepared for them. The average POTS diagnosis takes 4 to 7 years from symptom onset before COVID. Patients were routinely dismissed, told they had anxiety, told to drink more water and get more sleep. The condition was poorly taught in medical schools. Now we have a flood of post-COVID patients with the same symptom profile, and it's forcing the medical establishment to actually learn dysautonomia.
That's a grim silver lining, but it tracks. Nothing focuses the medical mind like prevalence.
The research acceleration has been real. The NIH's Recover Initiative has funded multiple studies on post-COVID autonomic dysfunction. Small fiber neuropathy biopsies, actually taking a small skin sample and counting the nerve fiber density, have become more widely used as a diagnostic tool. Before COVID, many neurologists weren't routinely doing these biopsies for POTS workups. Now it's becoming standard.
Let's talk about the small fiber biopsy. What does it actually show?
A punch biopsy, usually taken from the lower leg, stained to visualize the nerve fibers that cross the dermal-epidermal junction. You count the intraepidermal nerve fiber density per millimeter. Below a certain threshold, typically around 5 fibers per millimeter in the lower leg, adjusted for age and sex, you've got small fiber neuropathy. In post-COVID POTS patients, these densities are often reduced, sometimes severely.
You can literally see the nerve loss under a microscope.
And the loss correlates with autonomic dysfunction severity. The small fibers that are missing are the same ones that should be signaling blood vessel constriction and sweat gland function. Many of these patients also have abnormal quantitative pseudomotor axon reflex testing, QSART, which measures sweat production. The autonomic fibers aren't just missing structurally, the function is impaired.
Does this nerve damage recover?
Small nerve fibers can regenerate, unlike central nervous system neurons. They're peripheral nerves with the capacity for regrowth. But it's slow, millimeters per month, and recovery depends on whether the underlying insult is ongoing. If there are persistent autoantibodies attacking the nerves, regeneration will be limited until the immune process is controlled. Some patients improve over months to years, others don't.
That's a hard thing to tell a patient. Your nerves might grow back. They might not. We'll know in a year or two.
In the meantime, you're managing symptoms, which brings us back to sodium, electrolytes, compression garments, beta blockers, ivabradine, fludrocortisone, midodrin. There's a whole pharmacological toolkit, but the foundation is almost always volume expansion and salt.
I want to go back to something you said earlier about the diagnostic delay. 4 to 7 years on average. Why so long?
POTS primarily affects women. About 80 to 85% of patients are female, typically between 15 and 50. Young women with vague symptoms like fatigue, dizziness, and palpitations are frequently told it's anxiety or deconditioning. The tilt table test, which is the gold standard for diagnosis, isn't done in most primary care settings. Many doctors simply don't think of it. And the symptoms are heterogeneous. One patient might have primarily GI symptoms, another might have brain fog and fatigue, another might have near syncope. It doesn't present as a clean, obvious syndrome unless you know what you're looking for.
Tilt table testing is not exactly a routine procedure.
It's time-consuming, requires specialized equipment, and many hospitals don't have one. The alternative is a poor man's tilt table, literally having the patient lie down, measure heart rate and blood pressure, then stand and measure again at intervals. That's actually sufficient for diagnosis in many cases if you know the criteria. You don't need a 50,000 table to diagnose POTS. You need clinical awareness.
Part of the problem is that the diagnostic tool is actually simple, but the knowledge isn't distributed.
Any doctor with a blood pressure cuff and a pulse oximeter can do a stand test. The 30 beat per minute threshold is straightforward, but if you don't know the threshold, you don't look for it.
Let's go deeper on the hyperadrenergic subtype. You mentioned norepinephrine levels over 600 picograms per milliliter. What's normal?
Normal supine norepinephrine is around 100 to 400 picograms per milliliter. On standing, it might double. In hyperadrenergic POTS, standing levels can hit 600 to over 1,000. The sympathetic nervous system is flooding the body with catecholamines. These patients often describe feeling like they're having a panic attack every time they stand up. Racing heart, tremors, sweating, a sense of doom, but it's not psychiatric. It's a norepinephrine storm triggered by orthostatic stress.
That's probably why so many get the anxiety label.
It looks exactly like a panic attack. And the patient might say, this only happens when I stand up. And the clinician hears panic attacks in specific situations and thinks agoraphobia or anxiety disorder. The physiological basis gets missed entirely.
The treatment for hyperadrenergic POTS must be different from the hypovolemic subtype.
Sodium loading can actually worsen hyperadrenergic POTS if not done carefully, because expanding volume can trigger more sympathetic activation. These patients often benefit more from beta blockers, propranolol, metoprolol, at low doses to blunt the heart rate response. Clonidine or methyldopa, which are central sympatholytics, can reduce the norepinephrine surge. And evobradine, which slows the sinus node directly without affecting blood pressure, has become a go-to for many POTS patients regardless of subtype.
Evobradine is interesting. It's a funny channel blocker, right?
Yes, it blocks the IF channel, the funny current channel, in the sinoatrial node. It reduces heart rate without touching contractility or blood pressure. For POTS, that's nearly ideal, because you don't want to lower blood pressure in someone who's already struggling with cerebral perfusion. Beta blockers can lower blood pressure, evobradine generally doesn't.
The pharmacological toolkit is expanding, but it's all off-label, isn't it?
There's no FDA-approved medication specifically for POTS. Midodrine is approved for orthostatic hypotension, not POTS. Fludrocortisone is approved for adrenal insufficiency. Ivabradine is approved for heart failure and stable angina. Everything is being repurposed. It's a testament to how under-recognized the condition has been that there's no POTS-specific drug.
That seems like something the long COVID research wave might change.
There are clinical trials now specifically for post-COVID POTS that didn't exist 5 years ago. The patient population is large enough to recruit for proper randomized controlled trials. Before, POTS trials struggled with enrollment because the condition was considered rare, though prevalence estimates were always around 0.2 to 1% of the population, which is millions of people. It was underdiagnosed, not rare.
The distinction between prevalence and diagnosis rate is doing a lot of work there.
It always does. Irritable bowel syndrome, chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia. These conditions overlap significantly with POTS and share the same problem. High prevalence, low diagnosis rates, disproportionately affecting women, poorly understood mechanisms, and a history of being dismissed as psychosomatic.
There's a pattern there that's hard to ignore. Let's talk about the overlap with ME/CFS, myalgic encephalomyelitis, chronic fatigue syndrome, because long COVID seems to produce both.
The overlap is substantial. Studies suggest 30 to 50% of ME/CFS patients also meet POTS criteria. Both conditions involve autonomic dysfunction. Both can be triggered by viral infections. Both feature exercise intolerance and post-exertional malaise. The difference is that POTS has a clear hemodynamic signature, the heart rate increase on standing, while ME-CFS is more defined by the post-exertional crash.
If you have both, the exercise intolerance is compounded. You can't stand without tachycardia, and if you push through, you crash for days.
That's the clinical reality for a significant subset of long COVID patients. Graded exercise therapy, which was historically recommended for ME-CFS and sometimes for POTS deconditioning, can actually be harmful. If you have post-exertional malaise, pushing through worsens the condition. The newer guidelines emphasize pacing, staying within your energy envelope, rather than graded exercise.
That's a major shift in treatment philosophy.
It's been a hard-fought shift. Patient advocacy groups pushed back against graded exercise for years, and the data eventually supported them. For POTS without ME-CFS overlap, a carefully structured recumbent exercise program, starting with rowing machines, recumbent bikes, swimming, where you're not upright, can be very effective. The Levine Protocol, developed at UT Southwestern, starts patients exercising horizontally and gradually progresses to upright. It takes months, but it works for many.
You're literally starting people on their backs.
Because being upright is the stressor. If standing triggers your symptoms, you can't start a rehab program standing. You start supine, build cardiovascular fitness without orthostatic stress, and then slowly tilt upward over weeks to months. It's counterintuitive to traditional cardiac rehab, but it's physiologically logical.
This connects back to the sodium and electrolyte question, because all of these interventions are trying to compensate for a system that can't regulate itself properly. The sodium expands volume, the recumbent exercise builds fitness without triggering the feedback loop, the medications slow the heart or constrict the vessels. Everything is a workaround.
That's a fair characterization. We don't yet have a treatment that fixes the underlying autonomic dysfunction. We have interventions that compensate for it. The hope with the autoantibody research is that if you can identify patients whose POTS is immune-mediated, you might be able to treat the immune process, IVG, plasmapheresis, rituximab, and actually modify the disease rather than just managing symptoms.
IVIG for POTS. That's a serious escalation.
It's being tried. Case reports and small case series show some dramatic responses in patients with confirmed autoantibodies. But it's expensive, it's not without risks, and it's not appropriate for everyone. The key is identifying which patients have immune-mediated pathology versus other mechanisms.
The long COVID research push might actually crack POTS open for everyone, regardless of trigger.
That's the hope. The post-infectious mechanism is probably shared across multiple triggers. If researchers identify specific autoantibodies in post-COVID POTS, those same antibodies might be present in post-EBV POTS, post-influenza POTS. The viral trigger differs, but the downstream immune dysregulation might be similar.
Let me ask about something that's been in the back of my mind. The autonomic nervous system has two branches, sympathetic and parasympathetic. POTS is usually framed as sympathetic overactivity or failure of sympathetic vasoconstriction. What about the parasympathetic side?
The parasympathetic nervous system, mediated by the vagus nerve, is the rest and digest system. In POTS, parasympathetic tone is often reduced. There's a lower heart rate variability, which is a marker of poor parasympathetic function. The balance between sympathetic and parasympathetic activity is disrupted. Some researchers think the problem is less about one branch being too high and more about the loss of dynamic regulation between the two branches.
It's not just too much gas. It's also not enough brakes.
That's a useful metaphor. Heart rate variability, the beat-to-beat variation in heart rate, is largely driven by parasympathetic input. In healthy people, heart rate varies with breathing. Inhale, heart rate speeds up slightly. Exhale, it slows down. This is respiratory sinus arrhythmia, and it's a sign of good vagal tone. In many POTS patients, heart rate variability is blunted. The parasympathetic brake isn't engaging properly.
Some of the non-pharmacological interventions for POTS, like breathing exercises, vagal maneuvers, are they targeting this specifically?
The evidence for vagal toning exercises in POTS is limited but mechanistically plausible. Slow, deep breathing at around 6 breaths per minute can increase heart rate variability and baroreflex sensitivity. Some patients find it helpful for symptom management, but it's not a standalone treatment. It's adjunctive.
I want to circle back to something you mentioned about the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system being dysregulated. The hypovolemic POTS patients have low renin and low aldosterone. That's the opposite of what you'd expect if they're volume depleted.
Normally, if you're volume depleted, renin rises, which triggers angiotensin II, which triggers aldosterone, which tells the kidneys to retain sodium and water. In hypovolemic POTS, the system is paradoxically suppressed. Some researchers think there's a problem with the kidney's sodium handling, possibly a nephron-level defect that causes sodium wasting, and the renin-aldosterone system is suppressed in response to some other signal. The mechanism isn't fully understood.
The body is losing sodium, losing volume, and the system that should be screaming at the kidneys to hold on to sodium is quiet.
That's the puzzle, and it explains why simply increasing sodium intake works. You're bypassing the broken regulatory system by force feeding it substrate. If the kidneys won't hold on to sodium on their own, you give them so much sodium that they can't help but retain some.
It's the physiological equivalent of, if you want something done right, do it yourself.
And fludrocortisone, which is a synthetic mineralocorticoid, works by directly stimulating sodium retention in the kidneys, essentially doing aldosterone's job. It's effective for many hypovolemic POTS patients, but it requires monitoring because it also increases potassium excretion.
We've got a condition that affects millions, has been underdiagnosed for decades, disproportionately affects women, has multiple subtypes requiring different treatments, can be triggered by viral infections, and is now seeing a research renaissance because of long COVID. It sounds like we're at an inflection point.
The NIH is funding dedicated POTS research centers. The Dysautonomia International Conference has grown massively. Patient advocacy has been extraordinarily effective. And the sheer volume of post-COVID patients means that every cardiologist, every neurologist, every primary care doctor is now seeing these cases and having to learn.
Is there a risk that POTS becomes overdiagnosed now? The pendulum swinging too far?
It's possible. Sinus tachycardia on standing can be caused by deconditioning, by medications, by anemia, by hyperthyroidism. Not everyone with a high heart rate on standing has POTS. The diagnosis requires excluding other causes and meeting specific criteria. But given the historical underdiagnosis, I think we're still catching up, not overshooting.
What should someone do if they think they might have this? Daniel's prompt implies he's curious about the mechanism, but listeners might be connecting dots with their own symptoms.
The stand test is something you can do at home, roughly. Lie down for 10 minutes, measure your heart rate. Stand up, lean against a wall for support, measure again at 2, 5, and 10 minutes. If you're seeing a sustained increase of 30 beats per minute or more, that's worth discussing with a doctor. But don't self-diagnose. There are other conditions that can mimic POTS, and you want a proper workup.
The sodium loading. Don't just start consuming 10 grams of salt a day without medical supervision.
If you have hyperadrenergic POTS or undiagnosed hypertension, aggressive sodium loading can be harmful. This is a condition where you want a tilt table test or at least a proper stand test, maybe a small fiber biopsy, maybe catecholamine testing. Work with a doctor who knows dysautonomia.
Which brings us to the access problem. How many dysautonomia specialists are there?
Dysautonomia International maintains a provider directory, and there are pockets of expertise. Cleveland Clinic, Mayo Clinic, Vanderbilt, UT Southwestern, Johns Hopkins. But many patients travel across states or even internationally to see a specialist. Telemedicine has helped, but it's still a bottleneck.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
Hilbert, what do you have for us today?
During the Tang Dynasty, the Chinese imperial bureaucracy required officials to submit expense reports measured in bolts of silk, a single bolt being roughly 13 meters long. For comparison, the distance from N'Djamena to Lake Chad is approximately 100,000 meters, or about 7,700 bolts of silk.
A very specific unit conversion.
I have no idea what to do with that information, but I'll remember it forever. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want more episodes, head to My Weird Prompts. We'll be back soon.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. Thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.